think
I was on the floor of the stock exchange at that time. Not only on Wall Street, I was right in the middle of it.
What firm were you with then?
I was with a New York firm of O'Brien, Potter, and Stafford, at which I was a managing partner, as I had left Lehman Brothers with their blessing about a year before. It was a very poor time to leave, but I made that move in 1929, which is a very expensive one for me. But I was a member of the New York Stock Exchange at that time, and on the floor, October the 24th, the day of the big crash.
I have been alerting my listeners that the same thing has been happening recently to the stock market as I in 1929. Could you expound more fully on the stock market? Do you see any similarities today with that of yesterday?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, Dr. Beter, accurately. Let me refer to my views of what happened in 1929. We had gone through a great period of expansion, a deliberate expansion. And then the big international world powers decided that it was time to cut their melon. And so they withdrew credit very suddenly in Wall Street in October. And on October 29th, brokers' loans went up very much, and credit was withdrawn. Gold was shipped out of the country prior thereto. And therefore, it was a credit panic, and stock prices plummeted. There were many suicides. It was a very difficult, dangerous time. I remember that that Winston Churchill came over here and appeared on the balcony in the stock exchange to see the turmoil. But obviously, he must have had some pre-knowledge of this situation because he was a very close friend of Bernard Baruch, who knew the score. And I remember him appearing in the balcony, and nobody paid any attention to them because they were wondering whether they were alive or dead financially.
Weren't there some false starts and false beginnings?
There was a false beginning, Dr. Beter, about the middle of September, but that was merely the testing out of the market. Just like today, the market is being tested in a highly political market today, but in those days it was manipulated, and to my knowledge, by the international powers. Now, whether they're doing that today on a super type of operation, I don't know, but it certainly looks that way. It looks that way because there's a very real drive to put us into a internationally controlled one world government, which the American people certainly do not want to be put into, but they are highly unalerted to the danger.
Getting back to the political picture, how about the Chicago Convention? Did you attend that?
Yes, I attended that as a volunteer. Louis Howe didn't want me to go out there at all because he thought I'd mess things up. But I assured him that I wouldn't open my mouth politically, but just go there as a loyal supporter of my then father-in-law. I went out there on my own, and I had a very amusing experience there.
Could you tell us about it?
Dr. Beter, I didn't know anything about politics in those days, not that I know much about it now, but at the same time I was out there and an old friend of mine named Tom K. Smith from St. Louis was with the Prendergast Group, and they were pushing their Missouri candidate. And I said, "Tom, what are you doing up here?" And he said, "Oh, I'm up here just trying to push for Senator Rankin." And I said, "Well, you're wasting your time." Me bluffing 100%, but just talking out of the corner of my mouth. Oh, he said, "No." He said, "No." He said, "We got to do that." And he said, "I got to go to a meeting down there in a hotel right now. I'll see you later." So I said, "Where are you going?" And he mentioned the name of a hotel nearby, and I decided I'd go up there too. He said, "No, don't you come over here, Curtis. This is dangerous." "No," I said, "I'm coming over there. I have a message from Mr. Prendergast." And so I went over there. I got in the cab, and in 5 minutes I was there. I walked down the hall there, and there was a fellow standing out in front of this big door there, loaded with hardware. And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want to speak to Mr. Prendergast." He said, "What do you want to speak to him about?" I said, "That's my business." So he opened the door, and pretty soon Mr. Prendergast poked his head and said, "What do you want, young man?" I said, "Mr. Prendergast, I'm with the Roosevelt delegation. And if you really want to get on the bandwagon early, you better get on the Roosevelt bandwagon right away." He said, "When I need your advice, young man, I will let you know." And the door slammed in my face, and the guard thumbed in my direction, and I moved away and went back to the hotel.
And talking about Pendergast always brings to mind, Colonel, the name of Harry Truman. Do you think that he was in that room, too?
I couldn't sign an affidavit to that effect, but I'll bet you a red apple that he was in that room, because you've heard about the smoke-filled rooms, and after all, that wasn't child's play. That was the real McCoy going on, and Prendergast was cracking the whip, and I feel quite positive he was in there, although I know I had the pleasure of meeting the later President Harry Truman. When I left that hall at the suggestion of the guard, I went back to the hotel and bought a newspaper, went up to my room and walked in there, and what do you think happened when I walked into the room, Dr. Beter? The telephone was ringing, and Tom K. Smith's voice was on the other end of it. He says, Kurt, something has happened. I said, what's happened? He says, the Missouri delegation is going for Roosevelt early in the ball game. I said, nice work, Tom, old boy. And later on, he was promoted to be president of the bank. How do you like that?
And, of course, Colonel, Roosevelt went on to win the nomination. Did anything happen after that nomination?
Well, I think a very significant thing happened. On his way back, he, for some reason, instead of flying back to New York, he stopped off in Massachusetts to have a conference with E. Mandel House up there and others of the Woodrow Wilson regime and some of the high Democratic Party chieftains. And I had a feeling that some of his most important directives were given to him at that time. He went on later on in November to win the election, you may recall.
Right. Was that... That's a very important point, Colonel.
Yes, I think so, too.
Was that at Magnolia Beach?
At Magnolia, Mass., as near as I can...
Right.
As near as I can tell it. It was
right.
At the home of E. Mandel House, who was very much in retirement, but he was still very important with the powers that be in the Democratic Party.
Right. Now, was Louis Howe there?
Oh, yes. Very definitely.
Well, how do you link him up? You know, President Woodrow Wilson had his Colonel E. Mandel House. How would you compare him with Louis Howe as far as capability?
That's a good question. That's a very good question, Dr. Beter. I would say that E. Mandel House, who became the so-called alter ego of President Woodrow Wilson and Louis McHenry Howe, in many ways occupied similar slots in the political machine. Both were advisors to their respective mentors, or shall I say bosses, and at the same time both of them had intimate connection with the people who put up the money for the Democratic Party.
And FDR went on to get elected, as you know, as a result of the Depression.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Colonel, could you give us the atmosphere that prevailed in the country during that time? You know, at the present time, we're hearing about bank failures all over the country. It seems to me that the same scenario is being repeated here in America. Can you expound on the feelings at that time?
Dr. Beter, I think your observation is a very interesting one. The scenario is about to be repeated. In those days, of course, I knew a lot about it. And I went out of my way along about the middle of November, noticing that Mr. Hoover was trying to get a degree of cooperation from the Democratic hierarchy to collaborate with them on some formula to save a lot of these banks that were failing. I would say up to 10,000, Dr. Beter,
yes,
round figures, failed in the United States. You won't believe what I'm telling you. The Democratic hierarchy did not want to do anything with the Republican machine in Washington because they wanted the banks to fail, because their financial advisors wanted to buy those banks in at the very bottom, and that was a terrible thing. And thousands of people lost their deposits, and thousands of these banks went out of business. And I couldn't get the Democratic machine to move. They wanted to wait and wait and wait and let the thing go to the rock bottom, and then in late March, to have the thing come back there and have FDR look like he was the White Knight.
Well, apparently the same scenario is being repeated today with Nelson Rockefeller.
That I don't know, but there are certain signs that are very ominous to me on the horizon.
Now we're down to March the 4th, 1933, in Washington on the inauguration day.
Yeah, a cold, bleak day it was.
could you describe that day to us?
I can remember it very vividly. I will never forget that day, never. We started out early in the morning when everybody was a little nervous and jittery. We had to attend a religious service at the Episcopal Church, St. John's Episcopal Church in Washington. And as the cavalcade of cars, I was in the third car, past the hotel near the church. Out on the balcony was a friend of mine named Freddie Peabody, who had a high hat on and had been celebrating all the night before at a big party. And when he saw me in the third car there, he hollered out there from this balcony and broke the tension. He says, "Kurt, what are you doing down there in that car all dressed up like Astor's horse?" And I said, "Freddie, be careful. You'll fall off that fire escape." Well, everybody laughed, and it broke the tension. So he went in and had this church service there prior to the inauguration. And then up on the hill, FDR went up there and was duly sworn in with the Hoover family standing by there looking very, very quiet. And Hoover looked very tired. I can understand that. And then later on, they had the inaugural parade. And along about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I went out there with my little daughter, Sister. It was very cold, and I thought I'd like to see the cavalry go by, as I was always interested in cavalry. And I approached the inauguration stand, and much to my surprise, I might even say dismay, there was nobody there from the White House with General Douglas MacArthur, who was reviewing the troops. And I thought that was a great slight to the distinguished general.
Why wasn't President Roosevelt there viewing the inaugural
parade? Well, that's a good question.
Parade.
I think the president had a legitimate reason for not being there, because he had steel braces on his legs, which in that cold day would reflect the cold, and he couldn't stand up for an hour and a half. So therefore, it was my opinion that Jimmy or Johnny or Elliot or Franklin Jr., one of them should most certainly have been there to be with the general and fill in for their father, who could not stand the cold. But as I had my daughter with me, I watched it to the conclusion of the parade, and then I went back to the White House and went up to the room. I had the yellow room at that time. That was the first room on the left as you go up the stairs. And a very amusing thing happened. If you want to hear about that, I'd be glad to tell you.
What went on there?
Well, you will recall that they generally had a famous tea in the White House at 4 o'clock. And people from all over the country, particularly ladies, come from long distance to attend the tea party. Well, when I went in there about 3:30, it was a very cold day, as I say, and a friend of mine, who was the head of the International Business Machine Company, Tom Watson had given me a case of Hagen-Haig pinched Scotch whiskey. And I said, "Well, Mr. Watson, I have no political influence," but he said, "Oh, well, you're a nice fellow, you might as well have that." Well, everybody in the White House knew that I'd had this package, because it had to be opened on account of everybody had to open up package. So everybody knew I had some hair tonic upstairs there in that yellow room. Pretty soon my friends dropped in, and then I had friends of friends, and pretty soon friends of friends of friends dropped in, and pretty soon I had 78 people in that yellow room. And everybody was having a good time. I started out with asking for 6 glasses, and I ended up with a whole lot more. And when the party was really going strong, about 4:10, I got a note from the White House usher, who was a very tall, distinguished man. A note was on this silver tray, and I opened it and read it. And it read as follows, and I wish I'd kept it. It's wonderful, wonderful souvenir. "Dear Kurt, will you please stop dispensing largesse? I cannot start the White House tea." Signed, Eleanor Roosevelt. So therefore, tea emerged victorious.
I see. Well, it's a very beautiful picture you painted there, Colonel. But what was Tom Watson doing there?
Well, I don't know. IBM. He's a very important businessman, and you know they were going to close the banks, and I got private information that they were going to shut the banks, and I told him that. Oh, he said, "My Godfrey, Curtis," he says, "I've got a big bill over at the Mayfair Hotel." He says, I've got to go over there and get $500. Are you sure the banks are going to be closed? Now, yes, Mr. Watson, that's what I've been told. He says, thanks very much. I go over there and pay my bill, and I need $500. I said, well, Mr. Watson, you better go ahead and do it in a hurry. He says, I'm going to do it. Thank you very much, Curtis.
Well, that was very important information, Colonel. How did you come by that information?
Well, I was told that the banks were going to be closed by inside people there in the White House. That was the program there. They're going to close the banks for 2 or 3 days and they'll shuffle things around. In the meantime, the insiders can line up and buy some of the assets at a very cheap price at some of these closed banks.
Now, in 1934, we had the Congress ratify President Roosevelt's executive orders whereby he pegged the gold at $35 an ounce and also confirmed the illegal nationalization, if you please, of the people's property, that is gold, in 1933. Can you tell us what the atmosphere was around the signing or the passing of the gold bill in January 1934?
At that time, Dr. Beter, I was fairly naive with the political background there, but some of my more well-informed friends were furious and dismayed at Roosevelt's apparent perfidy in respect to the people of the United States to withdraw their gold, which he didn't have a right to do, and then turn that gold, so I am told, over to the Federal Reserve Bank without a receipt. Now, the Louis T. McFadden knows a lot about that, and anybody who wants to know more about it can look up and see what he had to say about that deal.
I have looked it up, Colonel. In January 1934, the gold bill was passed. Congressman Louis T. McFadden, who was chairman of the Banking and Currency Committee for 22 years, made a tremendous speech, and it was printed in the Congressional Record January 24. 1934. It was on the Gold Reserve Act of 1934, and I want to read some portion of it because I believe it's very pertinent at this point.
I think it's very pertinent, too. Please do, Dr. Beter.
I want to quote from Congressman McFadden at this point. Quote, you see, Mr. Chairman, under this bill, the United States Treasury has to pay for the gold. Although the gold belongs to the people, and was taken away from their bank deposits and their cash registers and their pocketbooks in the first place and put into the Federal Reserve Banks. And although the Federal Reserve Banks tricked and fooled the people into giving it to them for the Federal Reserve currency, which they now refuse to redeem, and although that gold does not belong to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, the United States Treasury has to pay the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks for it. Well, how does this bill propose to pay the Federal Reserve outfit? How does this bill provide that the government shall take over the stolen goods? It provides that the United States government shall give the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks new gold certificates to the full value of the loot. The gold certificates will give the Federal Reserve Banks and the Federal Reserve Board legal title to this gold.
That's incredible, Dr. Beter. That's incredible.
This is absolutely the way it reads. The legal title to this gold. And the United States Treasury will be nothing more than its physical custodian. The Secretary of the Treasury, who was Henry Morgenthau, Jr. at that time, will give the Federal Reserve Banks gold for their new gold certificates whenever they ask for it. It is a fraudulent transfer. And I continue. When the individual citizens of the United States were required to surrender their gold, they were required to surrender their gold certificates as well as their gold coin and bullion. The Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks are private corporations, but they did not obey the gold orders. They did not surrender any gold coin, gold certificates, or gold bullion. On the contrary, the gold which was commandeered from the people was given to them as a free gift. And now, after they have taken into their possession all the gold belonging to the people, they are ready to make a pretended transfer of that gold to the government. Evidently, There is a law for the common man and no law for the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, unquote.
Dr. Beda, how in the world can the Treasury Department give the people's gold to the Federal Reserve Bank?
It was all done illegally years ago, and as I have brought out recently in my audio tapes and audio books, this gold has now been transferred to the manipulators abroad. Do you feel that there was a plan as far back as 1943 and even as far back as 1933 to take the gold out of Fort Knox? Would you put that past your father-in-law?
Well, Dr. Beter, I think it was obvious to anybody to see the efforts of the financial powers that be to reduce the gold standard back of the Federal Reserve notes from 40% first, then down to 25%, and then lower. And then on the face of the bills, why there was a reduction of the redeemability of those bills progressively. And it was obvious to me that the reason that that was taking place, and this was long before I had the pleasure of reading some of your very interesting comments recently in the last year on the Fort Knox situation specifically, it was obvious to me that there was not the gold reserve in Fort Knox that the Treasury Department purported, because the redeemability feature was being consecutively reduced. And the question is, why? Why were they doing that? Because the gold wasn't there. I mean, it was just as simple as that. Anybody was reasonably informed on money, and I am.
Well, the intelligence community has informed me on many occasions that the gold is gone, that our figures, our balance sheets of the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, are fictitious. What I want to ask you, Colonel, is was the atmosphere so deceitful that they could plan the taking away of the gold?
Well, I think the atmosphere was very deceitful, Dr. Beda, way back there, and it disturbed me a great deal at the time. Not that I knew many of the specific details, but the atmosphere was a program to change our way of life in this country, and that included, I think, a dilution of the gold reserve behind our dollar at that time. Now, obviously, FDR didn't dream that up. Somebody told him to do that. And who told him to do that? My guess is that the important hierarchy of the International Money Boys in New York told him to do that through Henry Morgenthau and Harry Dexter White, his assistant.
Harry Dexter White, did you know anything about him?
Yes, I know some things about him. He was put in there to hold up Henry Morgenthau, Jr., the Secretary of the Treasury, because Henry's knowledge of finance was very superficial, as his father often commented. Harry Dexter White was a very erudite, very smart operator that was close to the international boys who told Henry what to do. And he was charged with activities which bordered treason. And before he was supposed to appear before the Senate to answer these charges, he had a heart attack, according to the newspapers, and purportedly died. Some people doubt that.
So those people who did hold gold and did not turn it in, because under the Federal Gold Reserve Act of 1934, those people who had the gold outside the continental United States or in the Philippines, they could bring their gold back and get $35 an ounce, while the peasants, that is us, who turned in our gold, we only got $20 an ounce. Now, they made a whopping profit there. So why couldn't
That's right.
So why couldn't they continue making enormous profits at the expense of the American people?
Well, I think that's a very plausible suggestion.
If the government is corrupt, our money will be corrupt.
That's right. That's right.
This brings me back to something that you told me earlier about the fact that Henry Morgenthau, Jr. was told to come down here and perform a service. In other words, he was supposed to come down here and follow orders. Whose orders, Colonel Dowell? I'm asking you now for the record. Whose orders do you think Henry Morgenthau, Jr. was following?
I think he very definitely followed the orders from the hierarchy of the New York International Bankers, Dr. Beter, and I think he admitted that very open-mindedly, as Henry Morgenthau really didn't know what was going on.
And here we have a man who was our Secretary of Treasury.
Well, he was put in there for that specific purpose.
But he was
just a puppet.
And this was during the most perilous days of our republic?
One of our most perilous days. We're perilous days today.
May I ask this? Do you believe that the Treasury Department is still in the clutches of these same people who then were able to take away the people's gold and now have it within their own pockets?
I think the situation is a very similar one, Dr. Beter.
So times have not changed?
I don't think they've changed a bit. In fact, I think they may have worsened.